Well, thank you very much. So indeed, this talk was a result of provocation on the part of David. Actually, my participation in this program is also a result of provocation on the part of David. And in fact, me speaking here is probably not a very good idea at all, because our program has six or five coordinators. Some of them are really off-shell, some of them are on the unphysical sheet, but at least four of them will be present here and very active, and they make, and I'm sure they have a totally different viewpoint on the subject which I'm going to present. So if you really want to understand what this program is about, you will be forced to have six introductions into the program, six Blackboard talks. So that's one thing. Another thing, so when David told me that I'm supposed to explain, after having heard one of the mathematics, well, maybe it was physics seminar, what is it all about? And I pondered about it for a while. I thought, well, I could probably explain how physics and mathematics are now interacting. But then I thought that, well, we are physicists after all, most of us are. And we are not interested in very special things. We like to think in general. So why talk only about physics and math? So I decided to talk about the theory of really everything. And so I would like to introduce a concept, including string theory. So you may find this amusing, maybe not. So actually, just before I start, I generally don't like people who think about how other people think. So I don't. So when somebody tells you that he knows how mathematicians think about the problem, or how physicists think about the problem, and there are many people who write books about this, I always have suspicions, because normally people who write books about it, they don't do that anymore. And so this is a dangerous path to try to, you know, explain how ideas propagate from one field into another and how they transform. So instead, I will not really present you a theory of the physics and math interaction, or actually general science interaction, but after some introduction, I will just give you a few examples which I believe can be explained to non-specialists, non-experts, and which will illustrate why we think at least the physics-math interaction is an interesting subject and very fruitful for both physicists and mathematicians. And most of these, since all of my examples will be related to string theory, I will also have to explain what string theory is about, even though we don't know what it is. So let me begin with some general remark. So the knowledge which humanity has accumulated over the, you know, all its history can be, in a sense, represented as a huge manifold, which is sort of covered by domains which we loosely call different sciences, like physics or math, mathematics, or biology or chemistry, or, as they will argue, string theory. But many more. So of course, this is a really huge object, and I tried to, well, so clearly there are all these disciplines have overlaps, because after all, every phenomenon which is interesting has many aspects which are best described by different sciences. For example, if you think about how the brain functions, there is a physicist viewpoint on that, there is a biologist viewpoint on that, there is a medical point viewpoint, and so on and so forth. Or if you take something even more exotic, like the phenomenon of love, so how would you describe love? So what science do you need for that? So some people think it's just chemistry, some people think it's it's about electromagnetism, Some people think it's mostly economics. Some people don't think economics is a science, but let's be generous and add it somewhere, I don't know. So it's clear that if you really want to describe something interesting, you have to use different tools. And some aspects are described best by one tool, some aspects of the phenomena are described best by different tools. So I decided to call this object a no-fold. So it's a manifold of knowledge. And of course, practical people would like to have also a half-fold, but but that I don't know what it is. And also for our journalist in residence, I have another name for this object. It's a psi-fold. But somehow I don't like it very much. So so as you will see from my presentation, I like mathematical concepts. So I'd like to compare this object with really a manifold which is covered by different coordinate systems. So in mathematics, you have and so it's, you use some coordinates. Local coordinates to describe different parts of the manifold, and there are some transition functions which relate these coordinates on the overlaps. So in a sense, these different sciences, these are like different coordinates for describing the nature or the knowledge. But the manifolds also have so these local descriptions are normally they're quite boring. So the interesting things happen really on the overlaps or also on the multiple overlaps. And so the real subject of the program which I'm going to present is located here. It's this triple overlap between string theory, physics, and math. And maybe these pieces will also be covered in a way.
What's the other piece that doesn't overlap physics and math?
I don't know. Since you see, the point is that we don't know what this object is. So we know, actually, I mean, the standard, no, I don't think so. I think it's a new science, actually. So, the conventional for the last 10 years way of drawing this block is really to draw it in this way, right? I'm not even sure how many corners, about five, right? So many of you have seen this picture of this murky picture of what string theory is. So it is not really an accurate comparison of each domain with just one coordinate system, because the domains themselves have substructure. So in string theory, for example, we have some sorts of definitions of the theory at some corners of its moduli space, but we don't really have a complete definition of what's inside. So it's a peculiar object. I also will argue that it's sort of non-simply connected. So you can sort of travel from one subject to another and come back with totally different look. So the ideas, which are like charged particles, which propagate on this manifold, they really propagate through either some handles or wormholes or whatever you like to call it, and they really come back and change. In fact, this recycling—well, it's not really recycling of ideas. The cycling of ideas is one of the driving forces of these overlapping fields. So,
Nikita.
Yes.
Any notion of one science being more fundamental than the other ones?
No. This point of view suggests that it's a misleading. It's that would be wrong. But who knows? Maybe given manifold, you can describe in very many different ways. So, for example, if you take a round sphere, you can cover it, let's say, by two coordinate patches. So you know so you can cover it by two coordinate patches by using two stereographic projections. And so you would say, well, you just need two viewpoints to describe the whole sphere. But you could also try to use more refined description. If you're always interested in the sphere as a manifold, this will not produce any new knowledge. So it may be that, in fact, you don't need these refined structures. You just need some nice viewpoints, some analog of this stereographic projection. But I don't know what it is, so I will not talk about that. So my interest here is really concerns mostly this part of this big picture. So if I was a mathematician, then I would have to start with a definition of what is string theory. But so this is why this part cannot belong to the math block, because we don't know what it is. And if I was a physicist, a real physicist, you know, the pure blood, then I would have to tell you what are the experimental predictions of string theory which were verified. And so this is why I also cannot put it entirely in that blob. Sorry? So some people say, well, this is just disjoint from both physics and math, and also from the whole science. And in fact, but I think they are just jealous. So I will try to convince you that. Sorry? Yes, it is related. Actually, it's related. Yes, yes. If you read, if you follow Brian Greene's career, then of course. But actually, Brian Greene is perhaps a misleading example. I would argue that. Well, I think the example which I was about to give you is hard to beat, actually. So many of my examples will rotate around Chan-Simons theory. So Simons, I think, is a better example of using this overlap. He didn't use much physics, though. He used a lot of physicists, though. So that could be. Okay. So now I will try to say something more serious. What's the question? No.
Your opinion whether the no-fold is compact?
Oh, good question. I was about to say it. So I believe it is compact, actually. And if you think about how you compactify it, it should become, I think it's on the boundary of this manifold, well, on the compactification set, seats sci-fi literature. And also, you know, the institutions for mentally challenged, which is a part of medicine, after all. So it's a, which is a part of no fault, obviously. So I think it's a, it is compact.
Knowledge is finite.
It's a good philosophical. It's a good point, actually. I think it does, actually. So, but I would not bet my life on it. So. You know, in mathematics, proving that something is compact sometimes is it's a really tough problem. So, okay. Sorry?
What would Google have to say about
it? Google?
Google.
Yodel. Yodel. I think Google will have more to say about this than Yodel. Yes, computer science. I forgot to put it there. Okay. now back. So when you think about, I'm also not a historian of science, although I mean, most of what I'm going to say will be probably not very interesting scientifically, because this will be more or less old subjects, but it's interesting historically. And so I would just try to give you a few examples. Ideas or concepts which arose both in physics and mathematics, sometimes at the same time, sometimes with some time difference of 5 to 10 years, and were developed independently for quite a while until some people realized that these actually were just talking about the same thing using different language. And then once this intertwining process took place, the ideas sort of really started to feed each other. So one example which I want to bring is what is known in mathematics as Morse theory. So Morse theory, in a loose form, it relates the topology of manifolds to the properties of of a generic function on this manifold. So you take a manifold and then you can map it to the real line. So usually this is called the height function. So you just you just think of this manifold as hanging somewhere and you just measure the height of each point. And so Morse theory relates the critical points of this function. If you have a function f, so you look at the points where this function its derivatives vanish, and it relates the basically the number of its critical points and certain data on how the gradient trajectories connect them. So this data is related to the topology of the manifold. So given the function, you look at all its critical points. So these are local minima or maxima or saddle points. And then you do certain manipulation. You look at the gradient trajectories which connect them. And you basically count how many such trajectories are. And given this data, you can calculate certain topological invariants of the manifold, notably the cohomology of this manifold. And so, and vice versa, if you know that your manifold is non-trivial topologically, then you can give a bound on the number of these critical points. F has to be several times differentiable. Does have to be an analytic function. There are some refining conditions. So it does not work for topological spaces, but it works for differentiable manifolds. So this is really an old theory. Well, old, I don't know. I don't remember when it was actually proposed, but it was used by mathematicians very successfully for a long time, and until let's say around 1982, Witten has realized that these ideas are actually related to totally, different looking kind of ideas which are developed in physics, namely the supersymmetry. So supersymmetry is a symmetry which relates bosons and fermions, and so it's a kind of symmetry which has not been yet observed in experiments, so it's still a theoretical concept, yet very attractive one. So Witten was analyzing the questions of when this supersymmetry can be broken, and in the simplest example of supersymmetric system, which turns out to be supersymmetric quantum mechanics, he realized that the topological invariants which mathematicians assign to the manifold are just the supersymmetric ground states. Cohomology M. And this procedure of looking at the critical points and gradient trajectories is precisely the quasi-classical analysis of these ground states. So in quantum mechanics, the potential, you get a potential which is roughly the gradient square of this function. So each of these critical points corresponds to a zero of the potential. Forgive me for not very accurate drawing. And then the gradient trajectories which connect these critical points are the instantons. And so the points where the gradient of f vanishes correspond to the approximate ground states. And then the trajectories, these are instantons which lift the otherwise bigger degeneracy of these ground states. And what mathematicians invented just by following their nose turns out to be precisely the instanton analysis of this problem. So, you could say, what good could it bring to us? Because, this is just a reformulation of the same problem. Yet mathematicians got very excited because now they had the different tools. They had different tools, and actually got a different perspective for this problem. And what they did was, I would say, very brave for mathematicians, because they almost immediately generalized this Morse theory to the infinite dimensional context, something which physicists should have done. But physicists didn't do that at the time. So what mathematicians did, they said, so you see now the ball is on the math camp. So it started in math, then it went to physics, now it goes back to math. So they said, let's study now, let's take as M the loop space of some manifold X. And these are developments of the mid-80s, where of course string theory was around. So physicists of course thought a lot about the loop space, but they just didn't think about this particular problem. So suppose X is a symplectic manifold. So it means that X is like a phase space of some classical mechanical problem. And in particular, it has a symplectic two-form, which I will write loosely as dpdq, the standard stuff. But now, if you look at the loop space, you can now define a natural function f on the loop space, which will be the integral of pdq, the standard object which we study in classical mechanics and sometimes even in quantum mechanics. So mathematicians asked a natural question. Suppose also X has a metric, simplicity dp squared plus dq squared, but that can be generalized. And so they ask, what are their critical points and what are the gradient trajectories? So what can we say about the topology of the loop space and sort of what sort of data we need to do that? If you just follow your nose, then essentially the solutions of gradient f equals to zero would be just constant loops. So p is constant and q is constant. But the interesting point is, what are the gradient trajectories? So now x is really a loop. So sigma goes, let's say, from 0 to 2 pi. So what are the gradient trajectories for this function? If you just compute the gradient with this metric, what you will get will be an equation on the holomorphic curve. So if capital W is P plus IQ, and little z is, so this dot is d by dt. D minus I sigma, then you get the condition that what is the image of the trajectory? The points of our loop space are loops, and now they move. So we have a tube which propagates on x. So this is the generic picture for a string propagating on some space. And now the condition for this tube is that it has to be holomorphic, or it's a particular case. Of minimal surface. And this is something which is very interesting from the string theory point of view, because I'm skipping lots of motivations, but in string theory, roughly speaking, we want to sum over the maps of Riemann surfaces into some target space. With weight e to the minus area. So these guys provide the saddle points for some sort of string theory, which has not been, of course, identified at the time. But nevertheless, mathematicians have constructed a certain theory of these objects, and they use them to produce invariants of symplectic manifolds. Now remember that in this Morse theory story, you had the gradient trajectory had to connect two critical points. So this guy has to start its life as a point-like loop, and then end up also as a point-like loop. So if you just do the Morse theory of the loop space, then you would end up studying what we call closed strings. But of course, we know that, well, we have closed strings, we have open strings. And so mathematicians were not stupid. They actually also thought about that. And so at the same time as they studied the maps of the loops, they also decided to study the maps of intervals. But then, well, mathematicians are careful, so what sort of boundary conditions can you put on these intervals, on the add points of these intervals? And so they thought about this, and in this context, it turned out that so if you have a symplectic manifold X, you should choose some Lagrangian submanifolds. So Lagrangian submanifolds are submanifolds where this, which have maximal dimension, where the symplectic form vanishes. So locally, they are described by what is called the generating function. So you choose some function S, and you write P as a function of Q in this form. And so that describes for you one submanifold, and then you can have another submanifold. So mathematicians decided to study the invariance of the symplectic manifold X together with this Lagrangian submanifolds in there. And so they studied the maps of intervals whose endpoints would be precisely on these Lagrangian submanifolds. Now we call these z-brains. So this was sort of a mathematical version and so these intervals, again by the same calculation, have to sweep holomorphic films, sort of. And so you count how many such holomorphic films you can attach to your Lagrangian submanifolds, and then give you some invariant. So this is called Floer Foucault homology theory. And for a while it was sort of developing independently from physics developments, which were really parallel, except that maybe more general, or maybe less general, I don't know. So this is one example of how these ideas go back and forth. This story has a continuation, which I will explain maybe later. But in order to get there, I need to present another interesting example of the physics-math interaction, which involves the Chern-Simons theory, which I already mentioned. So let's start again with a certain mathematical problem. So the math problem is a classification of knots in three dimensions. So you have a knot. As you can see, I'm not a specialist in the subject. So for me, it's not. I don't draw knots automatically. And you want to know whether one knot like that is can be deformed into another knot like that. So without breaking the ropes of which the knots are made of. So the mathematical approach to this problem is to assign to a knot an invariant, which will not change under these deformations. And then if you are given two knots, you just calculate the value of your invariant on two knots. And then if the values are different, then these knots are different. Of course, if the values are the same, you're in trouble. You have to invent some other invariant to distinguish them. And so mathematicians have invented really, well, rather sophisticated invariants, which are defined normally using precisely this picture which I drew. So you project your knot onto some two-dimensional plane, and then you look at each point where you have some intersection like that. And then these invariants are defined by giving rules how they change when you make what's called randomizer moves. So when you change this guy to this guy or to this guy. So the three basic situations which can occur. But in these approaches, it's the difficult part usually is to prove that this definition really gives you an invariant, that it does not depend on how you projected the knot on the plane. And well, there are many other issues. So this is where physics actually came to, well, became useful, because the physicist's viewpoint on this problem is the following: what these knots are good for. So where do we see something assigned to a contour in space? Well, that's a gauge theory. And so given a gauge, so in any gauge theory, you can assign an observable to a contour by taking the trace, the sum representation of the gauge group, the path ordered exponential of the gauge field. And so in any gauge theory, given the collection of knots, you could assign, so by taking expectation values of these Wilson loops, you will get something. Now, depending on what gauge theory you get, this answer will or will not depend on the actual shape of these contours. And so it's really not difficult to figure out under what conditions the value of the Wilson loop will not change under small deformations. You just take the variation of that guy, and what you will get at some point the curvature. Of your gauge field at the point where you slightly deform the contour. So if your gauge theory is such that the expectation value of F is zero, then the correlation functions of Wilson loops will give you topological invariance. And so such a theory was indeed known, and that's John Simon's theory. So if your theory is given by dissection, then then expectation values of these Wilson loops in John Simon's theory will give you invariance of the loops and of the knots in particular. And that way, some of these invariants which mathematicians invented, namely John's polynomial, were explained by Witten. And the invariance was explained because they were related to this natural gauge theory observables. Well, mathematicians appreciated this fact, but then they tried to move further. Who told you that the Jones polynomial is the ultimate invariant of the knot? In fact, it was known that it was not. So there are more refined polynomials. So mathematicians decided to take seriously this John Simon's theory, and they, as the graduate students, they sat down and developed the perturbation theory expansion of these Wilson loop observables. And so it was the work of Axelrod, Singer, and Kantsevich. So they developed usual Feynman rules for calculating these expectation values, and that gave, in principle, they gave the most general invariant you could think about, which is defined in these terms. So it was not clear, of course, at this point that would exhaust all possible invariants. Fortunately, approximately at the same time, another mathematician who had a totally different background, his name is Vasiliev, who was working in singularity theory, he came up with a theory of universal knot invariants. So the reason why singularity theory has something to do with that is that when you change the knot in a brutal way, you go through singularity. When you really cross, when you break the ropes and tie them back together. And so using the ideas of singularity theory, he came up with a general theory of this invariance, which was actually shown by Kantsevich to essentially coincide with the perturbation theory for universal John Simon's theory. So it's a perturbation theory where you don't specify the gauge group, you don't specify the value of the coupling constant, and instead of the matrix contractions, you just leave the diagrams as an answer. So if you want to contract some matrices in the way which Feynman rules tell you about, you just, instead of getting the number, you just tell, the answer is this picture. And so the invariant is the sum of these pictures with some coefficients. And so if you now compare the sums of these pictures for two knots, then you can tell whether they agree or not. Okay, so... actually, not quite. So there are some... there are some really weird issues, like the statement that the number of these invariants is denumerable, while the number of knots is non-denumerable, something like that. For all practical purposes, I think that gives a solution of the knot problem. But if you are really weird, then you could come up with with existence proof. There are knots which cannot be distinguished by this invariant. But I'm sure you will have to do something really weird to make the apologies. So that was an example of the bouncing, the idea between physics and mathematics camp. And then it actually, so we left it at the math camp, but then actually it came back to the physics camp. So it turned out that now these nice stories about knots and three-dimensional invariants and three-dimensional manifolds actually is related very much to this story of these holomorphic curves and what is in physics was realized to be just the example of a topological string. So it's a particular kind of string theory which is closely related to all these mathematical problems, but also is closely related to many physical problems, which I don't know if I will have time to mention. So roughly speaking, the idea is that if you have a have a three-dimensional manifold, M3, you can consider its cotangent bundle. And that would be the phase space, so that would be symplectic manifold. And so you can consider, the full six-dimensional space has a three-dimensional plane at each point of a three-dimensional manifold. And you can consider strings, open strings, which will end on M3. So the open strings which end on P equals to zero locus. So one can show that essentially this open string theory will reduce to Chern-Simons theory on this M3. And then if you want to study precisely this Wilson loop invariance, to each loop, so I should say the following way, that M3 itself is an example of Lagrangian brain. So it's one of these L's. It's the one which corresponds to S equals to zero, which is P equals to zero. But you can also invent more sophisticated Lagrangian submanifold. In particular, if you start with some contour C, so it's one-dimensional contour U so if some parameterized contour, let's say, then you can define another Lagrangian submanifold L, which will be the set of all P and Q such that Q sits on the contour and P annihilates all the tangent vectors to the contour. So at each point you have one equation on three P's, so you have two P's. So here over each guy here you have a two-dimensional plane sitting, and as you go around the contour they sweep a three-dimensional space, and so that's a second Lagrangian submanifold. And so you can study this floor invariance of this pair of submanifolds, the one which is associated to the contour and another which is just the basic one, and that will reproduce you this knot invariance from the string theory point of view. So that gives you stringy realization of this invariance. I have prepared, unfortunately, three or four more examples of interesting applications of mathematics ideas in string theory and string ideas in mathematics. So maybe, it will not be realistic to present them all. But one example which I like, which will probably not cover it at this program. So maybe this is why I will choose it here. It's the example of solving another mathematical problem using string theory. So this problem is called deformation quantization. Of course, when you hear the word quantization, you will think that's actually a physical problem. But the way it's formulated would convince you that that's, well, not really a physical problem. So you start. So in this problem, you start with a different kind of phase space. You start with what's called a Poisson manifold. It means that you can define what is the Poisson bracket between functions, but this Poisson, so there is a Poisson tensor, but this Poisson tensor doesn't have to be invertible. So all symplectic manifolds are Poisson manifolds, but not the converse is not true. So one example is, we can take R3, for example, as a Poisson manifold, and define the Poisson structure to be just epsilon ijk xk. So since it's a three-dimensional space, it cannot be symplectic. All symplectic manifolds are even-dimensional. Yet that's a nice Poisson structure. So the question in deformation quantization is to find a deformation of the product of the ordinary product on functions, which will cease to be commutative but will still be associative. And this product, well, depends on some formal parameter, which can be called Planck constant, although it's a formal parameter. And so you seek the solution in the following form. So you want the first order deformation, the failure of this product to be commutative in the first approximation to be given just the Poisson brackets, as we expect in ordinary quantization. And the problem is to find the remaining terms in this expansion. So this is why I say it's not really a physical problem. It's that in standard physical questions, you ask about the algebra of operators assigned to some classical system, but also about the representation of this algebra. So here, the problem is sort of forget about the representation, just give me the algebra. And it turns out that if you try to solve this problem using the conventional quantum mechanics, then because in quantum mechanics you always come up with some representation of the algebra, it turns out that, well, it wasn't for 30 years people could do that. That's basically the punchline. Until recently, Kantsevich came up with a formula for the full series, and his formula, and he didn't even hide this, was really the expectation value of three operators, well, essentially, in the open string theory . So you take you study essentially the maps of the disk into the manifold X. You can assign the to every function on the manifold X, you can find an operator in this model, and these are boundary operators. So you can insert these boundary operators and the simplest correlation function is a three-point function, so you have three of them. Let me call this H tilde. And then, so this model, so so this is some integral over X. There is some action. So this action is some free theory action plus a certain perturbation, which depends on this Poisson tensor pi. And so you can and the coefficient is roughly speaking alpha prime. So the alpha prime expansion gives the star product. Well, it gives the perturbative expression for the star product. So you just do the conformal perturbation theory with this perturbation, you get many insertions of this pi operator inside the disk, and then you have some Feynman rules, more or less standard Feynman rules for evaluating the successive terms in the expansion. And so using the ideas which are more or less standard in string theory, namely the factorization of this disk amplitude, one can prove that the resulting product is associative, which is the hard part of this construction. So, my time is up. There were several topics which I failed to mention. One of them involves the classification of smooth structures on four-dimensional manifolds in relation to supersymmetric Young-Mills theories, and vice versa, using the ideas of essentially Donaldson theory, proving some results about the supersymmetric Young-Mills theories. So this is one example of the truthful interaction between these topics. Another example is the heavy use of these topological strings to solve some problems of algebraic geometry from 19th century, like counting how many curves pass through how many points on a plane. This is something which was also, well, it was actually missed by physicists. It was sort of an obvious application, but physicists didn't grab this point because the main interest concerns strings propagating on rather special spaces, namely Calabi-Yau manifolds, while mathematicians realized that some of these aspects of this theory can be described for any symplectic manifold, not necessarily Calabi-Yau, in particular CP2. And so, well, this is sort of the modern version of the missed opportunities talk by Dyson, who, well, I should have actually mentioned that. So in addition to this Yost remark about the uselessness of mathematics of physicists, was also the remark of Dyson, who said that the successful marriage between physics and mathematics ended in divorce. That was just that was in 72. Well, it was before all these developments, but not very far, not long time before. So there are some physical applications, like and there are some physical issues which are quite interesting, which will be discussed at this program, like certain aspects of ADS-CFT correspondence, the emergence of integrable systems on both sides of the correspondence, and trying to relate them. Twister methods in string theory, and that concerns both strings on twister spaces and pure spinner approach to the superstring quantization, and perturbative superangular theory and string theory representation, and many other questions. And mathematicians also, well, one issue which is mysterious to me, which will probably be addressed with the help of Greg Moore when he arrives, is the interaction between number theory and physics. This is so number theory was believed by many mathematicians, including Gauss, whom David mentioned, to be really the queen of. But this queen seems to be very sort of reluctant to give in to the charms of string theory. So it's so many physicists, well, not so many physicists, but several physicists tried to force her into this field. But so far, it really looks like a rape. So nevertheless, well, there is some feeling that. There are some important issues which involve Langlands duality, for example, and superangular theory, and that could be one of the bridge points. And another involves the attractor mechanisms for black holes and the special arithmetic properties of Calabi-Yau, which correspond to these black holes, and some others. So, so on my map of this no-fault, the overlap between string theory, physics, and mathematics didn't take much space, but in my talk it took, of course, all of it. So I try to convince you that that's really an interesting and exciting subject, and we will try to profit from it as much as possible. Thank you very much. Yes.
Could you extend the input of physics in this? Can be understood as understanding the consequences of experimentally known existence of QCD? Or there are other inputs? What are the main inputs from physics? Where does it go from?
So, as you know, I mean, so string theory itself is also an example of recycling of one idea. So it arose originally from the attempt to describe strong interactions of hadrons, but then was beaten up by QCD to be not very useful in that respect. Then, fortunately, it was discovered that it contains massless spin-2 particles and could be used perhaps for describing quantum gravity, which otherwise resisted all more or less all other quantum field theory approaches. And then now, after making a long, long circle, going through the theory of everything, it comes back and people believe that it actually will be useful in describing the strong interactions, and QCD in particular. So if you mention that, if I'm not sure I quite understand your question, but if you mean that, for example, the existence of n equals 4 supranormals can be used to prove the existence of string theory.
Physics is experimental science. What is the most important experiment from the point of view of this? Which experiment led to this interaction between physics and mathematics?
Well, there are... okay, so... okay, that's a good point. So, you know, so physicists like to say that physics is experimental science. Actually, there are some mathematicians who also like to say that mathematics is experimental science. That well, you spend your nights trying to find some patterns in computer experiments, and then you come up with a mathematical theorem. So you could say that some of the inputs here came from mathematical experiments. So mathematicians try to count how many curves how many curves are on the Calabi-Yau quintic. They came up with one number, then the next number, then the third number, and then string theory came up with a prediction. And then, as you know, the story that which made into Brian Greene's book, there was a discrepancy, which was then attributed to the mathematician's error. So that was, success of theoretical theory in explaining a theoretical experiment. So if you ask me about the real, hardware experiment which could lead to some of these developments, I don't know. Maybe this knot invariance could be found in superconductors and stuff. Sorry? Yes. Yeah, yes. Right. So I could, okay, so as a teaser, I could actually draw a map of certain subjects which really have some extension to the condensed matter physics, for example, which is a very experimental science. So, but maybe I should not waste your time on it. But so the point is that, as in my general theory of the snowfall, it's even when you study some really mathematical issues like calculation of the topological string amplitudes, you end up solving the problem which condensed matter physicists solve or try to solve. Like you find that your problem can be mapped to the problem of electrons on random lattice or something like that, and so you could use the input from there to get some hints on what happens in your story, or the story with crystal melting and things like that.
Fair to say that the main input was here Feynman path integral, which we know works because we had experiment in QCD.
I would like to say yes. Unfortunately, I have a certain mental contradictions with that. So the reason why I'm reluctant to say that the main reason is that we know the path integral works in QCD, therefore it explains why all of this works. It doesn't explain why all of this works. And one example is precisely this Donaldson invariance. So Donaldson invariance, for those who don't know, they classify smooth structures on the manifold. So they distinguish whether two manifolds which can be mapped by continuous map one into another cannot be mapped by a differentiable map. So they're very sensitive to something which we normally, as physicists, we would not pay attention to, because who cares what happens at the Planck scale? I mean, at this point, if you don't know how to differentiate a function, you just take a difference between its values at the point and the point plus the Planck length. So you would think that in gauge theory, you always think that it's deep down is defined on some lattice, and then you just you normalize and then forget about the lattice. But so you would not think that the gauge theory, which is defined on the lattice, would know about the smooth structures on the manifold. Yet, the success of Witten's explanation of Donaldson theory was precisely that. He said that that's the supersymmetric angle theory which calculates this Donaldson invariance. So that means that this is most likely, this is not the standard regularization of the theory which you would use to define these path integrals. And I think it's really string theory which has to be used in defining them. So.
Okay, that's right.